Mr. Hunt's at the committee. Members, we have three bills on the agenda today, and the first one is with our own member, Representative Hayden. So, Representative Hayden, welcome to your committee. Is that your bill? Mr. Hayden, do you want to move your bill? And it would be to move it for possible inclusion in the committee, out of the committee bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, my name is Representative Jeff Hayden, and I move House File 522 to possible inclusion in the housing omnibus bill.
Okay.
Is that right?
Correct.
Great.
So, go forward.
So, thank you again, Madam Chair. House File 522. Is the bridging rental housing assistance allocation our bill, and it would appropriate $3.4 million in the 2010-2011 biennium from the general fund to the Housing Finance Agency for the Bridges Rental Assistance Program, and makes this appropriation in addition to any base appropriations for this purpose, and makes the appropriation part of the base.
Okay.
Stable housing is necessary for recovery. With so many people with mental illness living in poverty, finding and retaining affordable housing is difficult. A person living on SSI can't afford any housing market in Minnesota. According to the Wilder Foundation in their 2006 study, that over half or 52% of homeless adults and 54% of homeless youth, 17 or younger, report a recent diagnosis or treatment for serious mental illness. That is up from 2003, when it was 47% of adults and 42% of the youth. The Bridges program provides temporary support for people with serious and persistent mental illness, otherwise known as SPMI, while they are waiting to get on the federal Section 8 rental subsidy program. With Bridges, like Section 8, a low-income person with mental illness rents an apartment at a regular market rate and pay 30% of his or her income for rent. The program pays for the balance. The goal of the program is to provide stability in the lives of its recipients. Traditionally, Section 8 has served as reasonable housing for low-income programs. In recent years, we've seen waiting lists close or have long waiting lists for people that manage to get in. We see that waiting lists are closed or have long waiting lists for people that manage to get into the list before they are closed. Bridges serves as a vital program that is attempting to close the gap that leads to homelessness. There is a great need for a variety of housing options, such as adult foster care, supportive housing, and housing with services. Without affordable housing and the appropriate housing options, people with mental illness enter a more costly program and at the expense of great personal loss. The bill will increase the bridging housing subsidy from $3.4 million each year. The governor's budget has proposed $5.276 million for the biennium. Roughly 756 households were served under this program last year. This increase would serve over 300 new people on the program. Today we have Sue Aberholden, the executive director of NAMI. She's a frequent member of this committee. She's going to talk about some of the other issues, or some of the other aspects of Bridges, as well as we have a testifier that she's brought.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Sue Aberholden, executive director of NAMI Minnesota. And I just want to underline how important the Bridges program is. You really need safe and affordable housing in order to be able to focus on recovering from your mental illness. We always talk about recovery in terms of three things, a home, a job and a date on a Saturday night. And while we can't do anything about the date, you know, we can do something about the employment and the housing situation. What we found why Bridges is so effective is that it's very flexible. You know, you don't have to sit there and wait for years to get the Section 8 housing. If the county or the provider has it available, they can quickly move and, you know, get someone moving on that road to recovery, which really helps. Dale Place had contacted me last night, and Sandra was not able to come, but I wanted to just share Sandra's story. Due to domestic violence and undiagnosed mental and physical health symptoms, Sandra found herself jobless, homeless, and on the streets, living in abandoned buildings, in parks, and sleeping wherever she could. Her daughter was able to stay with family and friends. Dale Place helped Sandra to go to a doctor where she was diagnosed with bipolar disorder and many physical ailments, including fibromyalgia. Sandra received a Bridges subsidy with the help of her housing support specialist. She soon had a place to call home, and with help from her housing staff, was able to rebuild her life, which had fallen apart when she was homeless and had no medications for her mental illness. At present, Sandra regularly attends support groups, physical therapy, and is happy to have achieved greater stability in her own mental health. She is currently working towards getting a job. She is a thriving member of her community, regularly attends church, and helps take care of her grandchildren. Sandra has been actively applying for permanent housing with the help of the housing support staff, and she expects to be able to move off the Bridges subsidy soon. I now want to introduce Nicole, who will share her story.
Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Nicole Jurisic. I rent a small 700-square-foot, one-bedroom apartment in Stillwater on Orleans Street in Stillwater. There is no way that I could afford a one-bedroom apartment in this building in my community without Bridges helping me. Regular rent is not affordable to me. Rent would be about $700. I am on the waiting list for Section 8. The waiting time for my Section 8 is about 5 years. I am paying one-third of my income on my apartment. I appreciate this apartment for many reasons, and I can have my companion dog here as well. I am paying rent of $316 based on my income. Because of Bridges, I am able to pay for other bills. I can then pay my electric bill, renter's insurance, and car insurance. I do not have a computer or cell phone or cable, not any of those fancy things. I usually buy my clothes at the Goodwill and use the food shelf. Having the Bridges subsidy allows me to be connected to my community and to feel stable and safe. I can leave the building and not worry about my safety. My apartment is close to many of my family members. They do their best to understand my mental illness, and their support is very helpful to my wellness. I was homeless 4 times in 1 year. I do not want to move and lose my stability and ability to maintain my mental illness. I have lived in shelter homes, emergency foster care, and regular foster care. Losing Bridges would cause me stress and anxiety. I would worry about how I would live. Because of housing stability, I am now looking for employment. This program allows me to be self-sufficient and have a sense of home and security. I feel very good about that and being able to live here. I need this program very much. Thank you for listening to me.
Thank you. Any comments or questions? Representation?
Yeah, if I would, Madam Chair, I just want to just put some context on the Section 8 and the Section 8 waiting list. A few years ago in another capacity, I was a Section 8 administrator for a small Section 8 demonstration project that HUD had. It's currently still in effect at Mental Health Resources. When we started that project, we had 150 slots, and we got over 5,000 people to apply. And with the turnover, when I left there 2 years ago, there was still 3,500 people that were on the waiting list. And that is just a very, very small demonstration project. So you can imagine kind of the need for housing for people with disabilities. So I just want to kind of give you a sense of how important this program is. And though we're going to get people on the waiting list, there may be changes in HUD's waiting list and Section 8, our Housing Choice Voucher Program. But at this point, those vouchers have come really slowly. And I think that is just an add-on as to why we really need programs like this.
have a question about the waiting list as you described it. Was that just for people who were living with disabilities who were trying to get vaccinated? Was that the vaccinate waiting list in that area?
No, Madam Chair, that was just a small demonstration program for people, Section 811, just for people with disabilities. So there's a larger Section 8 waiting list, and each housing redevelopment agency or PHA should have a waiting list specific for disabilities, but this was just a small one that was separate from any large PHA.
Since you've had a background on this, do you know if most public PHAs do have a waiting list, and if what you were describing is kind of typical around the state or
yeah, Madam Chair, it's my understanding that most housing redevelopment agencies, HRAs or PHAs, have waiting lists. There may be small communities that turn over a little more. I know in Broward County and even in Carlton County, they turn over a little faster. But the large kind of cities of the first class, those are even suburbs, entering suburbs, those lists are long. I think Minneapolis opened it up last year and had an overwhelming response, and now their waiting list is closed again.
Okay, thank you. Okay. Any other comments or questions from committee members? Okay, if not, Representative Hayden renews his motion that House File 522 be passed and held over for possible inclusion in the committee bill, omnibus committee bill. Any further discussion? If not, I guess we don't need to vote on that one. We're just laying you over. So, thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Okay, we're going to be waiting just briefly here for Representative Rood. Representative Benson, could you take the chair for just a moment for me, please?
Welcome, Representative Rood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's been a crazy morning. I apologize.
I understand we have House File 522 for possible inclusion. We will be laying it over.
Yes.
293. Excuse me, I misspoke.
And there is an amendment. Move that. Maybe put it in the case.
This one. E2, right? All right, so it's amendment H0293DE2. And is it in the form that you wish it to be?
I don't actually have it in front of me, but I'm going to say yes.
Yeah. Yes.
Are you going to put it on here? Yes. Yeah. I don't know if it's the current one. Oh. Thank you. Great.
All right, then I move that the amendment be accepted as written. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Okay. Would you like to proceed, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It is really an honor to be before this committee. I've not been before this committee before. This bill is about colon cancer screening. It is an area that is near and dear to my heart. My grandfather, my mother, and my brother were all treated for colon cancer. And this bill, I think, it's a little bill, but it's a very elegant bill because it does a couple of things that we've been trying to work on here as a body. Healthcare reform was something that we worked very hard on last year, and I think we as a body gained an appreciation for the importance of early screening, early detection, and prevention. And we all recognize that it not only saves lives, but it saves dollars. And that's what this bill is intended to do. especially in the area of colon cancer, where screening can pick up polyps that can be removed, thus preventing the cancer from developing in the first place. I'm sorry, Mom, that's because I ran from the Capitol to the meeting. I'm sorry. I work as a nurse practitioner. Some of you may know that. And there are a few things more heartbreaking than seeing somebody struggle with cancer and knowing that had they just gotten in for their screening, their cancer could have been detected at an earlier and more treatable stage or prevented altogether. Although Minnesota has long been noted as one of the healthiest states in the nation, there are significant health disparities in our state. Research has found that people of color, including American Indians, experience shorter lifespans, higher rates of infant mortality, higher rates of diabetes, heart disease, cancer, and other diseases and conditions, and poorer general health. In Minnesota, Minnesota has a few notable cancer health disparities. The American Indian men in Minnesota have the highest rate of colon cancer. It is more than 80% higher than the rates of white males. American Indian have the highest rates of colon cancer in the state. And this bill takes a step in the direction of addressing health disparities. And finally, what this bill does is it positions Minnesota to be ready to receive federal dollars, thereby maximizing our limited resources. So basically what this bill does is it directs the Department of Health to fund two demonstration projects, one at Henson County Medical Center and one at MeriCare in Bemidji, which are directed to serve populations that have been identified as high risk for colon cancer and uninsured, and to provide colon cancer screening. It also then asks the University of Minnesota School of Public Health to evaluate the program, come back to the legislature to report to us, and let us know how we may further address this issue. That's really it in a nutshell. I do have some testifiers, and if that's okay with you, Mr. Chair, I would like them to speak.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Arms, and if you would introduce yourself for the record and proceed, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is David Arons. I'm the Director of Government Relations for the American Cancer Society in Minnesota. Cancer is Minnesota's leading cause of death, and according to the latest statistics, one out of every two Minnesotans will be diagnosed with a potentially serious cancer in their lifetime. One out of two. Fighting cancer is a mission we all share in this state. Now, this month is National Colon Cancer Awareness Month, so it's appropriate today that we're talking about this bill, and we urge your support today for the inclusion of Minnesota's Colorectal Cancer Prevention Act into the state budget. Colorectal cancer and the prevention of it is most often a private matter and handled between an individual and their doctor, and that will always be the case. However, the prevention of colorectal cancer is now a public health issue and a health cost financing and cost containment issue. First, the public health issue. Colorectal cancer is one of the most preventable forms of cancer because potentially cancerous polyps inside the colon can be detected and removed all in one day, depending on the screening test. If screened, a person's survival rate from colon cancer goes up to 90%. If they don't get screened early, that survival rate may drop into the single digits. 850 Minnesotans die each year from colon cancer, but it doesn't have to be this way if more Minnesotans were screened. Colorectal cancer is also a public health issue due to the fact that when a person lacks health insurance that covers preventative screening, a cancer may not be detected early. If found as cancer, some Minnesotans without health insurance were turned to public resources for treatment, including uncompensated care at hospitals and clinics and public health insurance programs. Now, with 7.4% of Minnesotans lacking health insurance, and the number may be growing due to the economy, even more Minnesotans may go without colon cancer screening. That's a troubling scenario. Now, as Representative Rood mentioned, colorectal cancer is also a health disparities issue. Health disparities are gaps in the quality of health care and access to health care across economic, racial, and ethnic groups. By providing colorectal cancer screening to more Minnesotans that are more likely to get colon cancer due to health disparities, including the uninsured and at-risk groups, we can close gaps and improve equality in health care for Minnesotans, consistent with what the legislature's task force and the governor's task force were saying in their two health care commission reports more than a year ago. Second, colorectal cancer screening is a public finance of health care issue and a cost containment issue. This bill aims to reduce state health care costs leverage partnerships, and attract federal prevention dollars. The bill would establish, as Representative Rue mentioned, a small demonstration project at two hospitals that have existing capacity, a desire to tackle colon cancer, and gastroenterologists who are ready to go to screen people that are ready for screening. In addition, the American Cancer Society will contribute up to $25,000 in in-kind patient education services to this project. We're ready to bring our resources to bear to make this work. The two hospitals would provide the screening at a cost somewhere between $1,000 to $2,000 per patient for approximately 200 patients. Now, by removing the precancerous polyps, on a per-patient basis, we can save between $16,000 to $200,000 in potential per-patient treatment costs. That means a $1,000 colonoscopy, for example, could remove polyps and save the state or private insurance or that patient somewhere between $16,000 and $200,000 in treatment costs. That's starting to add up to big numbers. Uninsured and underinsured people are also more likely to delay getting preventative screening until they wait till the symptoms show up. So this demonstration project targets people without symptoms, removing polyps while you can prevent the cancer before it needs cancer treatment. Second, the cost of screening 200 people can be very high, as I mentioned. But how many people are going to have cancer in this demonstration project? Well, if we screen about 200 people, statistics show that about 1% are going to find out cancer. So that's about 1 to 2 people in this demonstration project. So can screen 200 people, save $16,000 to $200,000 per patient. If you find cancer in 1 to 2 people, then it's going to be at the low end of the treatment range and not very costly. The benefit really here is the screening, because screening either rules out the existence of cancer, giving us, I think, even more peace of mind than getting our taxes done properly, or it detects early treatment when the costs are lowest. The bill also positions Minnesota to be considered for federal matching dollars at a 3-to-1 ratio from the federal government. And this is where the federal government piece kicks in. Is Congress reintroduced a bill 2 weeks ago. It's H.R. 1189, introduced by Representative Patrick Kennedy and Representative Kay Granger, a Democrat and Republican, that would create a stream of funding through the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention that would provide existing state-level programs with matching funds. However, according to the bill, only existing state-level programs may receive special consideration for the funding, which means Minnesota needs to have something in place, no matter how small, to get in line for this federal matching dollars. Currently, 11 other states have colorectal cancer screening programs, but of course Minnesota does not. The key aim of this bill is not only to screen, save lives, and reduce potential treatment costs, but it's trying to position Minnesota to maximize potential dollars, federal dollars, for colorectal cancer screening, and use a form of prevention where there is absolutely no doubt about the way it works. There's many forms of prevention where there is some ambiguity, but it's well worth doing it anyway. Colorectal cancer screening, depending on the type of test, there's no ambiguity. It works. You pull out the polyps, no cancer. The fiscal note is being prepared, but we anticipate the cost of the state to be fairly low. We estimate maybe between $400,000 to $700,000, maybe lower than that, depending on where the costs come in. Statistically, we know that out of about 200 patients, 50 will have polyps. So right there, we have a chance of removing a lot of potential cancers. Now, based on the estimated treatment costs, the potential savings to the state by investing somewhere between $400,000 to $700,000, maybe $3 to $6, depending on the fiscal note, could be around $1.8 million in cost savings to the state. And that assumes that some of the people found out screening would go on to public health insurance programs, or they would go to emergency rooms and uncompensated care. So we're trying to save the state dollars here. I think maybe around $1.8 million. Finally, this bill does not increase the size of government. Rather, it leverages the enormous talent we have in our state to tackle colon cancer in the same aggressive way we've been addressing the burden of tobacco. This bill is consistent with our goals in trying to balance the budget, but moves forward with initiatives that save lives and use resources wisely and leverages federal funding. American Cancer Society asks for your support for House File 293, and we very much thank this committee for considering this bill to try to prevent Minnesota's leading cause of death in our state. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Ahrens. Are there any questions from committee? Representative Howell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You mentioned 200 people, and I thought you said without symptoms.
Correct.
Mr. Chair.
Who gets, how do you decide who gets, do we put an ad in the paper?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, Representative House, there's eligibility criteria in the bill. To be eligible, to be screened by Hennepin County Medical Center or Medicare, that in the demonstration project, a person would need to be age 50 or over, and or at high risk depending on their family history of colon cancer. They'd also need to be under 250% of the federal poverty level, so they would need to be almost medical assistance eligible by income and resources to do this. So they, to even get a colonoscopy, you first need to be 50 or high risk, according to national guidelines. So it's not everybody, it's just a small group.
Representative Hobbs.
Mr. Chairman, but if I'm 55, okay, boy, that was a long time ago. how are you going to get a hold of me and tell me I can do this? That's what I can't grasp. I know the requirements, eligibilities, but... Do you put an ad in the paper and say, we're going to do 100 people in Bemidji, we're going to do 100 people in Hennepin County, or do you open a phone book and get every 100 person?
Mr. Chair, Representative Howes, one of the reasons why these two institutions were selected is because they don't have to do outreach. They already have lists of people who are ready to go. One of the ways we wanted to reduce costs in this bill is oftentimes... people either don't want to come in for colorectal cancer screening or they just don't know about the benefits of it. But to do that outreach is expensive, but it's very much worth it. In this case, to reduce the outreach costs, we worked with two institutions that are really ready to go. They have groups that are ready to be screened, and they can simply call them on the phone and say, come in for screening.
Two more, Mr. Chairman. I noticed... there's not a dollar amount in the bill. Would that be forthcoming, or is that something we do later? Or
Mr. Aaron.
Mr. Chair, Representative House, the fiscal note, the formal fiscal note is forthcoming. It's been requested, and I know there, both the Health Department and the Department of Human Services, the Health Department on the screening portion and the Department of Human Services on the treatment portion, are finalizing their respective numbers. We expect their numbers to be very modest, lower than actually the Cancer Society did our own estimates. We thought this bill would be somewhere between a 400,000 to 700,000 range, and we expect that number to be hopefully either in the middle or at the low range based on the numbers we're using. And we are very happy to share with anyone how we calculated the numbers based on the studies.
Okay. Two more questions, Mr. Chairman. I'm not trying to filibuster the bill. but I noticed on page 1, line 13, and I'm sure there's an explanation for this, or we do this all the time, is under the age of 65. When I first read that, I think that means if you're over 65, forget it, we're just going to let you die.
Mr. Chair, very good question. The reason why 65 is the age cap is because that's when Medicare would kick in and cover this.
Okay, and I still have one other one on page 2, line 19. One of the eligibility things, follow-up services for abnormal tests, and wouldn't it, at least to me, who doesn't understand all these medical terms sometimes, wouldn't it be abnormal test results?
Yeah.
Or how can you have an abnormal test?
Mr. Aaron.
I might defer to Representative Reed as a
Representative Reed.
I suppose technically, I'm thinking with if you do a colonoscopy and you find a polyp and you excise it and you have the pathology is abnormal, so I guess technically it would be abnormal test results. We have a physician in the audience. I'm looking at her for her. I think
Representative Lewitt, or Mr. Chairman, I would certainly like it if you would do an amendment, or if I could do an amendment to get rid of the S and stick in results, if that would be okay with the chair.
I would accept that as a friendly amendment.
All right. Let's get this straight, exactly where we are.
So I would move, Mr. Chairman, on line page 2, line 19 of the delete all amendment, in the word test, strike the S and insert space results.
All right. Test. And then what? All right. And do you accept that
yes.
as friendly amendment? Okay, then we don't need to have a vote.
Well, I believe, do we? We still have
we still need a vote? Okay.
There's no such thing as a friendly amendment.
Any? not in this legislature. And by the way, Representative Howard, I appreciate your asking a question about the age limit.
I have you in mind, Mr. Chairman.
I'm greatly relieved.
I have a few years to go, but I'm catching up.
Well, I'm already there. any discussion on this proposed amendment? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Okay. And let's continue.
Thank you. You have another question.
Anything?
Adopted.
Oh.
There we are.
The amendment is
done. Oh, I'm done.
All right. Any other questions from the committee for our presenter? Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Aarons, one of the questions I've got here is, it follows on a little bit with Representative Howes was speaking to, and that is the 200 cases that you're identifying here on a recurrent with a positive test, obviously, as a follow-up requirement. You said that about 25% of the individuals that would be tested would probably come up positive, I believe, was for polyps. And so the number, have you calculated this into your estimates that that if you get 25%, they're going to have to be retested within 6 months or a year or whatever that process is?
Mr. Aaron.
Mr. Chair, Representative Stevenson, yes, the polyps need to be re-looked at again. But once someone has found that polyp, they're going to need to come back in for another colonoscopy or another type of colon cancer test within about 5 years. If they had no polyps, they probably wouldn't need a colonoscopy for about 10 years. But if you find polyps, there is some follow-up pathology that needs to be done. You need to look at the polyps itself, and that's part of what these two institutions would do, is examine the polyps, determine what they mean, and then recommend to the patient what they need to do next.
Representative Stevenson.
And I guess to that point, and this is just a point of consideration, is that if you get into this, you have the 25% that you've identified that now have polyps, you run out of funding, now you have identified them as a potential higher risk, and your funding runs out, what do you do?
Karen.
Good question, Representative Stevenson, Mr. Chair. They are at high risk, and we hope that the sheer knowledge of knowing that you're at higher risk of colon cancer, if you're deemed at high risk by your gastroenterologist, your oncologist, then that's good information. But this program has to draw lines at some point, and if we find cancer, then it will be treated. If someone is found as polyps, but is shown to be at high risk and maybe need of further appointments down the road, then, you know, there are limitations to what this bill can do, because we have to find ways to do the best we can with reasonable costs. But we know that from taking a look at the SAGE program, which is Minnesota's Breast and Cervical Cancer Program, in its early years, it offered screening only, but not treatment. And so there's a history of doing screening, but without treatment. But in this case, there is a treatment component, but your point is very well taken that if someone is deemed at high risk, yes, they're going to need follow-up appointments, and there's not necessarily a financial path for them to continue having that. But we're doing the best we can with this type of bill.
Yes, Mr. Chair, if I can add, I think that's also part of the, thank you, Mr. Chair, the project evaluation. And that's something that we as a body historically, I think, are a little lax in as far as implementing something and then looking at it, you know, evaluating it and seeing how we can change it as we move forward. So we want to look and see the results of the demonstration project and then perhaps change what we do in the future.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions for our testifier? Well, thank you, Mr. Aaron. Appreciate it. And we have another testifier, Linda Roberts. If you would identify yourself for the record and welcome to the committee, and please proceed.
Mr. Chair and the members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to speak today. My name is Linda Roberts, and I'm the Women's Health Case Manager at the Indian Health Board. We provide medical, dental, and counseling services to more than 7,000 patients in the Phillips neighborhood of Minneapolis each year, regardless of their insurance status. Services are offered on a sliding scale, and no one is ever turned away. The Indian Health Board strongly supports HF-293, the Minnesota Colorectal Cancer Prevention Act. We are proud on our emphasis on prevention and in serving the needs of those with chronic disease. We currently reach at least 100 uninsured or underinsured women each year with the help of the Minnesota Department of Health Stage Breast Cancer Screening Program. But every week I see patients who are at risk for colorectal cancer but cannot afford to pay the cost of a colonoscopy. HF-293 is a much-needed resource that will extend prevention services to the underserved population. Native American men have the highest rates of colorectal cancer as any group in Minnesota. Their risk of being diagnosed with the disease is 50% higher than those of their non-Hispanic white counterparts. Age and family history are risk factors for the disease, but because colon cancer is preventable through screening, not being screened is actually a major risk factor, but one that is modifiable. That is, we can do something about it. We can't stop aging and we can't change our genetics, but we can get screened. If everyone were screened as recommended, we could reduce colon cancer by more than half. The state of Minnesota has made a commitment to reduce health disparities. HF-293 moves these goals forward by focusing prevention services on a population where even a small investment will have a significant impact. The Indian Health Board urges you to support HF-293. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for us from the committee? Representative Clark.
Thank you.
Chair Clark.
Thank you for your testimony. I wanted to know if we, and I don't know if you can answer this, Ms. Roberts, or maybe one of the other witnesses, are we getting a handle on why the rate is so much higher in American Indian populations, particularly American Indian men? Do we know anything about that yet?
Ms. Roberts or Mr. Aaron? Aaron.
The cause of colon cancer, there's nothing definitive, but whether it could be access to care, nutrition, could be genetics. Hormones have an effect in why some people have cancer, some don't. Genetic makeup. There are many of these reasons. Of course, environmental concerns are at play, but it's difficult to pinpoint one particular thing over another with American Indians or any particular population. The American Cancer Society has found that it's usually a bunch of factors.
Mm-hmm. Clark.
Is there anything in the screening protocol that might help us get at any of those kinds of issues?
Mr. Aaron.
Well, when someone comes in for screening for this, they're going to be asked questions, and they're going to be asked, we're going to get to know them. The hospital will get to know them, and hopefully can get at some of these things, and that's part of the evaluation component, and it's why we asked the Minnesota Department of Health to consult with the University of Minnesota's School of Public Health, because Professor Tim Church there has been doing a lot of research on colon cancer and is in a position, I think, to work with the experts at MDH, with the Cancer Society and these institutions, to work as a partnership to try to figure out why do people have cancer, and to get them screened and really take a hard look, so that if we're evaluating this rigorously, appropriately, and in a way that helps us think about how we move forward to prevent cancer, not just through screening, but through eliminating the things that cause cancer.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee members for either a testifier? Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Roberts, for being here. I'm curious, or maybe this is for the author of the bill. Have any of you approached, like, the Minnewaukan tribe as a possibility of funding this with their success at the casino?
You know what? I didn't have a chance to talk to Dr.
Roberts
to get more of the details, but I know he's on board with his, on this bill. So I think he may have approached him. I work with them as far as the mammography, the breast cancer. So they come into the clinic, or they pull their mobile unit over, and we do have screening a couple times a year. So, okay. I mean, that's probably a good possibility.
Okay. Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just think with their recent successes and their ability to be the only state in the nation that gets all this money that they don't share with the state government, it would be a great opportunity for them to reach out to your community and the close ties that you have to fund these kind of things. I think it would be a terrific outreach. So I'm hopeful that Representative Root and yourself would reach out to them and say this is really an important issue that we're faced with, and we're hopeful that in these tough times that maybe they can reach out and help you out.
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, the Shakopee Midwaukee and Sioux Business Council has been a really strong partner with the American Cancer Society, focusing on colorectal cancer, and they've been part of the Minnesota Cancer Alliance. I think your point's really well taken, is to talk with them more about this project, since they are so interested in preventing colon cancer.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to follow up on that. Ms. Roberts, could you speak just a little bit as to the support that you receive from the Shakopee tribe or even tribes throughout the state? I think that would be helpful to know that, to understand how much support you do get from them.
Ms. Roberts.
Well, I can speak to the effect of the support I get through as far as the projects I work on, but as far as the overall clinic, I'm not sure how that, you know, ties in, but they do. We have an agreement that they would come in with the mobile unit, mm-hmm. and then I would actually be doing all the recruitment. So they come in and we recruit the women for mammograms and such. So that's basically how I work with them through the program. I work with the SAGE program and the education for breast and cervical cancer prevention.
That's true. Can you quantify that? Do you know how many women get screened through the SAGE program, Ms. Roberts?
Ms. Roberts. We screen probably about around 100 per year.
Per year. Do you know about how much that costs? And you may or may not know this. I'm just trying to get at, I think what I'm trying to get at is that I think that the tribes do support urban Indian programs and that they may be a potential partner here, but they are in an ongoing way supporting health programs in the urban Indian health centers, if you will.
I don't know to what extent that would be, though.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? Representative Rude, would you like to make a concluding statement?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. That's it.
Right.
I would appreciate your support.
All right. This bill will be laid over then for possible inclusion. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, moving right along, we have one more bill before us, Representative Dean. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is House File 113, and I'm requesting that House File 113 be held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus finance bill.
I'll move that for you, Representative Dean. That the House File 113 be recommended to be laid over for possible inclusion. Go right ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This bill deals with our loan forgiveness program for underserved areas of the state and underserved areas of practice within the state. This deals with pediatric, psychiatric, mental health workers, mid-level providers. And what we've found in the committee that I serve on is that one of the issues that we're really grappling with is getting the right care at the right place at the right time across the state of Minnesota. And we've had real access problems in the state, particularly in the area of psychiatric help and also pediatric mental health services throughout the state. Probably no greater need than pediatric psychiatric help for folks across the state of Minnesota. What this bill does is it intends to reach out to more people to serve in this area. What you may have heard on the floor and in the past years is we have a shortage of mental health beds in the state of Minnesota, and we're trying to address that. One of the major problems that we've had is that the folks that are taking up these beds, very expensive to the state of Minnesota, have no place to go. So what we need is we need more mid-level support back in the community. And what this does is it extends our loan forgiveness program to mid-level folks who can provide that next tier of help in the community. The Department of Human Services, at our request, is currently putting together a report on intensive services work group. And within that, they have a workforce shortages group and report that is due out this week, which will back up the need for this particular extension for folks in mid-level pediatric psychiatric care. That'll be released this week. NAMI supports this bill, and I would appreciate your support and welcome any questions that you might have.
Any questions or comments? Any members? I have just a couple. What would be an example of a mid-level practitioner?
That would be a registered nurse,
mm-hmm.
Also a physician's assistant, and folks that would be able to possibly, I would have to check on if we have a legislative, if we legislatively define mid-level provider. To my knowledge, we do not. But these would be folks who are assisting both in the care facilities within the bill and also in the community.
Well, the word's been in statute, so maybe there is. That would be helpful to know if there is a definition. Now, it sounds like this is not limited to the rural areas then, right? It's statewide. The first part of the existing statute talks about rural areas, and then this says or in these areas, but this would be statewide in the specific practice areas?
Yes, Madam Chair. This is trying to address both geographic disparities and clinical disparities within this area.
Any other questions, comments? Oh, Representative Stevenson?
Thanks, Madam Chair, and Representative Dean. I'm trying to get my arms around this thing. So what we're saying is this is kind of a loan forgiveness program for services rendered in the field in the intermediate level of mental health and some of those. So if there are organizations that are out that are currently employing these people, then do the credits go to the individual? They go to the organization. How does this get facilitated? Or am I understanding this correctly?
Have a good day.
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, currently we provide loan forgiveness through the Department of Health, through the Department of Human Services for these folks who enter these fields in underserved areas. So that is the personal loan forgiveness. So in order to get folks to practice in areas where we used to have a doctor and now we don't, that was a need that we started in 1990. We started that program. and we started 1990. In 2007, we had about $7.8 million in loan forgiveness to try to address both geographic disparities and clinical disparities. So that's what this was trying to do, is to try to attract and retain the most qualified folks in underserved areas and specialties.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative, just a question. It does talk about the Commissioner of Health uses the money to send. Aren't they the ones who administer the program then?
Yes, I'm sorry. Did
maybe,
I?
Maybe they misspoke. He misspoke. Yeah. Okay. All right.
Okay.
Okay. Any further questions? If not, this bill will then be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Committee bill. Thank you very
much.
Thank you,
Madam Chair and members. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Committee members, we're done early today with our bills, and so we'll get a little break. I just wanted to see, we'll get the minutes here in a second. I also want to mention that I've set up an opportunity for Republican members of the committee to meet with me, give me your advice, your suggestions on what you think we should be doing with the budget now that we have the final forecast. I believe that's tomorrow at 10, so just in case anybody... Republican members didn't get that. Please, I'm really looking forward to, you know, a good discussion with you in room 400 south. Okay. The minutes are before us. Representative Morgan, would you like the minutes of the last meeting?
Madam Chair, I'll move the minutes of Wednesday, March 4, as submitted.
Thank you. Any discussion on those minutes? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, no. Motion be zero. The minutes are adopted. And without any further discussion, the committee is adjourned.